As we've gone through Hebrews, we wanted to be able to see Jesus, but then something else keeps coming at us all throughout the book of Hebrews, and that is we, separated by far from the concept of the Old Covenant, we actually get a peek at the importance and magnitude and grandeur of the Old Covenant, little by little throughout the book. But as we start to consider the Old Covenant as we go through this book, a lot of times it raises the question of, all right, what really is the relationship of the Old Covenant with the New? How much of that stuff actually has some sort of bearing on how I'm meant to live my life? What is the connection between those two things? The passage that we'll read today does a really deep job. I mean, we're talking deep stuff today. So if you need to kind of just like slap cold water on your face just to get your attention span ready for this one, it's going to require a little bit of that. Because there is incredible stuff that we're going to plumb the depths of today. Matter of fact, some of this stuff that I've never appreciated before taking this slow, long look with a lot of study at the brilliance of God as He has established not only the first covenant, but the way that He set it aside and culminated it all in this second covenant in which we live. Now, the original recipients of this letter, they lived in the Old Covenant. They knew the Old Covenant. They actually had life experience in both covenants. For them, it's a whole lot easier to appreciate. For us, we just got to do our best to imagine what it must have been like then, and then to realize, whoa, as cool and as august as all it was that we experienced in the Old Covenant is now coming to something even more brilliant. How sweet and brilliant is our God? That's the hope. Let's see how we do as we take a look at this. Now, we left off in one of the more amazing passages on grace that really did cause my knees to tremble as we took communion together in our outdoor service, and that was in 9:14. There it says, and I'll use this as a reminder of where we left off and then launch in to this next section. How much more, and there's a comparison here between Old Testament sacrifice and New Testament sacrifice, how much more then will the blood of Christ, who, through the eternal Spirit, offered himself unblemished to God, how much more will that sacrifice, the blood of Christ, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve? That's a loaded term. It's the word of the official capacity of a priest to be in the inner sanctum, backstage pass, all access pass to all things in the tabernacle of God. So we have actually had the blood of Christ not just cleanse us ceremonially, but the blood of Christ to reach in and actually do something that could have never been known in the Old Covenant, cleanse our consciences. In the Old Testament, it was only a cleansing from unintentional sin. Intentional sin, you're cut off. In the New Covenant, intentional sin, acts that lead to death, in other words, even that is cleansed from our consciences. So that there's nothing that would cause us to think, oh, but I did this. Can I actually share about Jesus here? It seems like I'm disqualified. Even that. It was brilliant what Marcel shared even during his communion, the depth of where we were in the before picture. Even that. But yeah, you don't know what I've done. Even that. Right. Even that is lifted fully, without evidence at all in the sight of God, from your conscience. None of that is there.
Right.
Not because you're all that, but because Jesus interceded with such power in that intercession that it brings you clean as imaginable.
Wow.
And now there is nothing to keep you back from serving with gusto the living God.
Amen.
Well, because of that, and that's grace. Oh my goodness. Is it ever? Now, it will now say, for this reason, in order for us to serve the living God, to be cleansed from all of that, for that reason, that's what God wants to accomplish, for this reason, now check it out as we read through here. And I'll try to keep us somewhat in focus as we go here. For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. These just sound like religious words, but these are incredible bombs that are being dropped on this audience. For them to know that there is an eternal blessing that is ironclad, that's pretty amazing. But the word covenant is going to come into play here too. Now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant. In the case of a will, it is necessary to prove the death of the one who made it. Because a will is in force only when someone has died. It never takes effect while the one who made it is living. Why? Didn't it seem like odd? Like, why are you bringing a will into play here? What's up with the will? Where does the will come in? There's never any mention of a will all throughout the New Testament. There's not really even a mention of a will in the Old Testament. Why a will? Well, here is what catches us off guard that would not catch the original audience off guard, because they would be hearing the original words, not the translated words. The word for will and the word for covenant are the exact same word. They just have such a kind of a breadth of meaning that it actually encompasses both of those ideas. And as a matter of fact, a word that is very similar to that is the word testament. And matter of fact, I think that's why often the old covenant is called the Old Testament and the new covenant is called the New Testament. When do we use the word testament in everyday language? That's exactly right. Young man up front, 5 points. It is when we use the phrase last will and testament. And it's at that moment where the executor is behind the big mahogany desk, and there we all are sitting around saying, oh, this is sad, but what do I get? And the last will and testament is read. And in such an agreement or settlement, all of these are kind of the same word here. Greek word, diatheke, in case you're really burning to know what that Greek word was. If not, forget that I said it. All right, but the same concept encompasses both this word that ends up being covenant, testament, settlement, or will. But it speaks to the arrangement that we have with God when he makes the connection to us, or when he makes the connection, more importantly here, to his chosen people, Israel. When he reaches down, pulls Israel up out of Egypt, says, you are my chosen people, with you I will make this connection. And he does so through a testament, a will and testament, not just simply a covenant. Sometimes I think when we hear covenant, we think more, well, it's more like a marriage. Yes, it is, in the beauty and the intimacy and the wonder between God and his people. But in terms of how the terms are laid out and how it has power, or how the agreement goes into effect, it goes into effect the same way a last will and testament goes into effect. And as it says here, it doesn't go into effect until you can show me the body. I need proof of death in order for this payout to occur. And so that kind of lends itself to a bit of mystery here with regards to the Old Testament, or the old will, or the old covenant. I'm going to read on. Are you guys okay?
Yeah.
All right. All right, so This is why even the first covenant or the first will was not put into effect without blood. When Moses had proclaimed every command of the law to all the people, he took the blood of calves together with water, scarlet, wool, branches, hyssop, and sprinkled the scroll. In other words, he sprinkled the Bible and all of God's people. He said, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you to keep. In the same way, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle, everything used in its ceremonies. In fact, the law requires that nearly everything be cleansed with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Okay, I'm going to stop here for a second. We are going to read on to the end of this chapter. But this is blow away if we can hang with it for a second. My view of the Old Testament has often been, what's up with all the blood, God? Are you bloodthirsty? Like, do you need all of these animals to be killed to fulfill some sort of a, I don't know, some sort of a desire that I don't really get by a long shot? Why all the blood? As a matter of fact, this is a reference to Exodus 24. Anybody else have that feeling ever as you kind of read through? Just super back there. Okay, great. I'm going to preach to you. No, I... But in the Old Covenant, Exodus is the part of the Old Covenant that explains how this testament, this will, this settlement, this agreement is put together between God and his people. First, he lifts them out of slavery from Egypt, and then he says to them, you're my people, and now here is how our agreement is going to work. And then from Exodus chapter 20 all the way to 24, he lays out the terms of the testament. Ten Commandments is what begins it, and then all the rest of the terms. And the terms are amazing. I mean, for the people of that time to hear such justice. Even when I read it now, I think, oh my goodness, what it must have been like to have read this and see justice for the alien. It's interesting for today's climate. Justice for women, justice for children, justice for orphans, protection for the marginalized of society. What nation could have ever even imagined having such a system of righteousness to guide them? And so the surrounding nations were in awe of Israel and often said those very things. What nation has such righteous laws as you? And after all of the covenant conditions were laid out in Exodus 24, Moses brings them to the people and he reads them to the people. And as he reads them to the people, 3 million people, having read this, must have grown weak in the knees at the beauty of this relationship that is given to them. The way that their relationships with one another would be governed as well in keeping to the conditions. And they all said, and it says in one voice, we will obey everything in the covenant and its laws. I'm sure with gusto and vigor and excitement, they in one voice said, you got it. What a deal. Praise God that this is our connection. And then Exodus 25, all the way to the end of Exodus, then has Moses going up on the mountaintop. And for the most part, it's all about God showing Moses. It's very interesting. These models. Like, okay, here's a model of the tabernacle. All right, this is a little kind of a depiction of what the Ark of the Covenant will look like. Here's what I want, the table on which you put the showbread. Here's the altar. Here's the basin. And it shows all of these little models by which Moses is to make the copies of the heavenly. And all these models that God is showing Moses on the mountaintop are patterns that will then be used to make the tabernacle, the place of worship, and all the utensils and systems of worship. But they're described as simply being shadows or sketches or mere representations, but not the real thing, of what's actually in heaven itself. And God is trying as best as Moses could understand, or any of us in our flesh could understand, to take this mere shadow of representation of really, I mean, blow away glory up there, Moses. But here, take this model and put it into practice. And we're going to read about these models in just a minute here in this passage. So anyway, Exodus then becomes, here's the covenant, here's the connection that we've got. Will you do it? We will do it! Okay, here's how it's going to play itself out with regards to this covenant being renewed and practiced and worshipped in the place where I want it to be, in the tabernacle. And so then God gives them the models. Now, with regards to this question I was asking, what about this blood thing? Like, why is it that God requires so much blood? As a matter of fact, this scene here in Exodus 24 has Moses killing a variety of cows and goats and other animals, and then gathering the blood, separating them into two big basins, and then using bowls. And then with that, he takes the blood and he sprinkles the law, the scroll. He sprinkles the priestly garments. He sprinkles the tabernacle. He sprinkles all of everything that is used as models to show us the way to God. And all of this is required because they needed to be cleansed by blood. But it's still, why? Why is that? Well, here, we read this carefully, and I think we'll start to realize why all this blood. Verse 17, a will is in force only when someone has died. Never does it take effect while the one who has made it is living. So the Old Testament doesn't come into force, even though God has laid it out, Exodus 20 to 24. He has laid it out. Here it is. Here's the document. But in order for it to be activated, energized, or validated, it needs something. It needs the person who wrote it to die. Then and only then, according to what we just read here in Hebrews, will the old covenant, the old will, the first will, be put into effect. Now, how is that going to happen then? Let's read the next verse. This is why, what I just read, this is why even the first covenant was not put into effect without blood. As a matter of fact, when the covenant was put into effect, verse 20, this is the blood of the last will and testament. This is the blood of the will which God has commanded you to keep this will. So I don't know if you're getting this, but ultimately what we need to get is this. God is not looking just for a bunch of blood from bulls and animals. Those bulls and animals then become representative of his self-sacrificial, life-giving blood. This is God saying to Israel, all right, I'm giving you the models of the heavenly things here, and I'm also giving you the representative of the heavenly testator. That's the person who writes the will. I am giving you a model of my blood as well. That's a pretty important deal. The whole old covenant also was only put into effect by the gracious, self-sacrificial lifeblood of God represented through this animal sacrifice. And that animal sacrifice then, as a mere representative, washed all the representative models of the tabernacle and all the things of worship for God's people. But even in the first will, in the first agreement, in the first settlement, it was always about a God who gives it all up so that his people could have a connection with him. Not some bloodthirsty God, but a God who wants to remind us through every one of those sacrifices, this is only in effect because God has laid himself down. This is only in effect because you have a God who's willing to give you his all. Now, when the new covenant is going to be put into effect, it's no longer about being connected through the representations or models of the heavenlies. Yeah. It's now preparing us to actually enter into the heavenlies itself. Yeah. And to enter into the heavenlies itself in this new covenant, that new will also needs to be put into effect with blood. Right. But representative blood or model blood won't do it anymore. It's going to require real blood. And my one and only point today, there will be blood. Real blood. Let's read. It was necessary, verse 23, then, for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these sacrifices. So the copies were purified with copies of blood. But the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a sanctuary made with human hands that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. Guys, this is so blow away. I think if we get this, and it's, you know, sometimes these high concepts you get for a minute, they feel like they kind of slip through your fingers. You're like, I know God is awesome. I just have a sense of it. But specifically, I don't always get. let's take a moment and let's just get it for a moment here. Because we now are given access not just to the tent and the inner sanction of the inner sanctuary of the tent. We're given access into the real tabernacle of God itself in heaven. Not just the scariness of going from the holy place to the holy of holy place. Oh my goodness, I'm inside this curtain of the tent. No, 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 no. We're talking about the blowaway reality of God in heaven, the presence of God. The presence of God so devastatingly awesome that the mighty cherubim and seraphim are covering their faces because of the glory and its power, the peals of thunder and the majesty of the very presence of God. The new covenant, the new will, the new settlement, the new relationship that Jesus is bringing in for us is not about the copies now. It's about preparing us for the eternal inheritance, the eternal blessings from this will, and preparing us to enter into that itself. But then it says, but these heavenly things need to be purified with better sacrifices. Well, why does heaven need to be purified with sacrifice? Isn't heaven already perfect? Yes. But guess who's going to be in heaven? You are. You too. The guy who raised his hand in the back. You too. We all are. And the reason for the better sacrifice, and the reason for the sacrifice that's not just a copy sacrifice, but the real deal, real thing sacrifice, is because that sacrifice is preparing you and you and you and you and even me to be able to enter into the reality itself. The old will, the first will, was a model trying to get us to even begin to appreciate and dimensionalize with all of its grandeur and brilliance that the one that was coming is going to be even more astounding. And when does this one come? It comes in Jesus. Let's read on. Verse 25. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself again and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place year after year with blood that's not his own. It's referring to the Day of Atonement, the big day when all sins are made right by the high priest. Jesus doesn't do it that way. He does it one time. Otherwise, verse 26, Christ would have had to suffer many times, every fall, every year, since the creation of the world. But he has appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages. That word is translated different ways in our different English Bibles, but the essence of culmination is a word that means connection. And it completes everything that was before it, and it itself is not complete without the stuff that it just connected to. And Jesus comes to basically complete all of that model worship, all of that model sacrifice, all of that model testament, and take it, and with what he does, complete it in order for it to be the full picture of God's full plan that he always had in place for all that awaited the realness and for all that now already know the realness. And so the Old Testament is put into its right and proper function, and Jesus now comes to tie up all the bows in a fantastic way. But he appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages, middle 26, to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Now we're looking at the blood of God. I would imagine never in the Old Covenant, as they understood, this tabernacle is a model. This lampstand's a model. This scroll is a model. We people, maybe we're a model, but we're not. But everything, the ark, the basin, the altar, it's all models. And the blood that's going on it, likewise, models. All representation of the realness. And ultimately, we're going to know the realness. We're going to enter into the realness. But could there actually be a sacrifice that's not a model sacrifice? Could there be a death of this will, a death regarding this will, that could be real rather than model. And they must have thought, well, the only logical conclusion would be that God would somehow have to die. God would somehow have to shed his own blood. Real blood. Not just representative blood. Could that ever be? And I would imagine they thought, I don't see how that could ever be. Must have been so hard to appreciate Jesus when he came. But yet, it's exactly what God did. He stepped it up all the way. And God, then as in now, is saying, all right, here's the agreement. Here's how it works. It only goes into effect if I give you everything. And I lay down everything for you, my precious possession. But he appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Just as people are destined to die once and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many. And he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. He will appear a second time. It's kind of in a reference to what actually goes on in the Day of Atonement. That the... hold on a sec, let me just get my... In the Day of Atonement, the high priest goes in to make sacrifice. He bears sin of all the people through the sacrificial goat, but goes in and then makes sacrifice in the Holy of Holies. But when he comes out of the Holy of Holies, it's not to do anything more with sin. It's simply just to lift his hands in beautiful celebration that we have successfully this year made all of our sin debt right before the Lord. And I'm sure with a shockwave among millions that celebrate vigorously the top of their lungs, the fact that God has allowed them to be fully reconciled to him. Now it says here, when Jesus returns, it's kind of like that high priest. Jesus has gone into the heavenly sanctuary. And he has gone there to make sacrifice for us. And when he comes out the next time, it's not to kind of say, oh, I forgot you, you, and you. No. When he comes out the next time, it's not to deal with sin anymore. It's to come out hands raised, victorious, celebratory, to be able to say, finally what we've all been waiting for. Oh, it's ready to go down. Because you're ready to go up. New Jerusalem is coming on down. And all of it is going to be put together. And it's going to be fantastic. Everything that I worked for is about to now come together for you for eternal inheritance. It's time for you not just to hear the will read. It's time for you now to cash on in. You're going to get a new body. You're going to get a new earth. You're going to get a new existence. No more tears. No more nothing. Only the blessings of everything that God has always so dearly wanted to shower upon you and indeed has and has indeed told you about. But you always wondered, is it really true? And it's really true. And here you go with all of it. And it is beautifully overwhelming. An amazing connection, old and new. But for us, when we realize, wow, what God has done fully, completely, inexhaustibly, but then it's easy to think, well, maybe, since Jesus has already paid all the price, maybe I can kind of slack a little bit here. This is going to forgive me, right? He did it once for all. It's covered. Earlier in the sermon, that guy pointed to me and said, yes, your sin. I guess it's all covered. That was by no means his intent. That we would turn grace into a license. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer saw the effects of this in early 20th century Europe when European Christianity began to grow very stale and cold and lifeless. And he wrote in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, in the opening chapter, a chapter entitled Cheap Grace versus Costly Grace. Let me read an excerpt of that for you. Cheap grace means grace sold on the market like discount wares. The sacraments, the forgiveness of sin, the consolations of religion, they're thrown away at cut-rate prices. Grace is seemingly the church's inexhaustible treasury from which she showers blessings with generous hands without asking any questions or fixing any limits. Grace without price, grace without cost. The essence of grace, we suppose, is that our account has been paid and in advance. And because it has been paid, everything can be had by us for nothing. Since the cost was infinite, the possibilities of us using it and spending it are likewise infinite. But what would grace be if it were not cheap? Cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion, forgiveness without confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without a cross, grace without Jesus. Costly grace, on the other hand, is that treasure hidden in the field. And for the sake of it, a man will sell all that he has and go and acquire it.
Yes.
It is the pearl of great price to buy that which the merchant will sell all his goods. It's the kingly rule of Christ, for whose sake a man will pluck out his eye, which might cause him to stumble away from his dominion. It is the call of Jesus Christ at which the disciple leaves his nets and follows him. Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again, the gift which must be asked for, the door at which a man must knock. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow. It is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus. It's costly because it costs a man his life. It's grace because it gives a man the only true life. It's costly because it condemns sin. Grace because it lifts up sinners. Above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his Son. You were bought at a price. And what has cost God much can never be cheap for us. Above all, it is grace because God did not consider his Son too dear a price to pay for us, but delivered him up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God and the sacrifice of God himself. And we stand at the culmination of the ages, brothers and sisters. We have the perspective of all of God's brilliance, all of God's love, and the fullness of God's plan. We can marvel at his love and the significance of who we are in the arc of God's sovereign timeline. And we, seeing it all, need to ask, what am I doing with the blessings that have been given to me as I hear this will being read out and I'm getting more than I could have ever imagined? Am I squandering it? Or am I letting everybody know how dear and precious these gifts given to me really are? Does your redeemed life reflect the value of God's own blood? We walk around because we have been purchased, because we are considered precious, because we are considered valuable beyond reckoning by a God who sacrificed all for us. It's why it makes so much sense in the New Testament that you see the widow who has two small mites, copper mites on which to live, and she gives them to God. She's in an agreement with God who has done the very same for her. How the man sells all, having seen the treasure hidden in the field. How disciple after disciple gladly say, "We've left everything to follow you." And how those same disciples gave even of their lives. Peter crucified in Rome. Paul head chopped off in Rome. Matthew killed in Alexandria. Mark drugged through the streets and then bludgeoned over the head in Ethiopia. Thomas preaching in India, run through with a lance. Bartholomew skinned alive. Luke hung from an olive tree in Greece. One after another, having given their all, gladly, because they know the one in whom they have this covenant, the blessings of this will. And they also know that those blessings are not just here and now blessings to be squandered for self-satisfaction, but rather the blessings extend so far beyond. And as the passage begins, it is the promised eternal inheritance. This week, all I ask, as magnificent as this passage is, all I ask is please meditate on how brilliant God's costly sacrifice was for you. And ask yourself how you can make it clear through your life the value of what it is that God has done for us. God bless you.